Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking proven ways to reduce your rent with Justin Pogue.
So a recent stat showed that over 44 million American households are renters. That is a lot of people. There are more folks renting right now than at any point since 1965. And with ever-increasing rents, we felt that it is time to focus on some proven ways to reduce that monthly expense. Justin Pogue is our guest today, and he's an author and real estate consultant who works with property management companies and investors. Since 2003, he's developed and managed apartments, rental homes, student housing all across the United States. Apartment Therapy, Realtor.com, Fox News, they have all featured his insights, and we are glad that he is now here with us on How to Money to talk about ways to reduce rent. So Justin, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
Justin, we're glad to have you. And of course, you know, Matt and I, we drink a craft beer on every episode because one, we like craft beer. And two, it's this way to do something, spend money in a way that aligns with our values now while we're saving and investing well for the future. Do you have a similar splurge that you make in your life?
Absolutely. And I really like this question because people think, oh, you're budgeting, you're frugal, so your life must suck.
that is what we're combating right
yeah.
here.
Yeah. But it absolutely is not the case. So where I splurge is I actually go out dancing at nightclubs.
There you go.
All right. So I'll go out and get like two or three drinks and, you know, have money to like tip people and all that stuff. But even when I'm doing that, I'm still doing it in a frugal way. So like, okay. I'm never paying to park in their parking lot. I arrive before they start charging cover or before they increase cover.
Yes.
I drink water between my adult beverages. And something else I do
is awesome.
When I do that, I only pay with cash.
Okay.
So I'm limiting my spending and there's no chance that my card gets charged for other people's adult beverages without my consent.
I'm all about how Justin is approaching a night out.
Yeah.
Showing up with first of all, I love that you start with just even where you park, because it's like, I'm not going to roll up to the door and have the valet. Let's park around the block. We can all walk a couple blocks.
The paid parking adds a chunk onto the bill for that night, you know?
But the cash, that's just a great way to do it. Keeps that spending in check. Justin, thank you for sharing that. As we dive into talking about rents here, we want to talk about sort of like what, you know, it's like an elephant in the room almost, right? Rent prices have gone up at a rapid clip. Recent data from rent.com, they show that rents on one bedroom and two bedroom apartments are both up double digits on average nationwide. We've talked a lot about inflation here on the show, but I'm curious to hear your take on what is happening in the rental market right now.
Yeah, so the general inflation situation is factoring into those rental price increases, but it's actually more than that, and it's actually systemic. The vast majority of land in the country that is zoned for housing is zoned for low-density, single-family housing, which creates a real problem because that means you're going to have fewer livable units. If they're all one-story and they all have to have a certain lot size and they all have to have certain setbacks, you're not using your land efficiently to create the maximum number of livable units for that particular community. There have been some small steps in the direction of changing that. So like in the state of California, you're now allowed, if you own a single family house, you're now allowed to add in what's called an ADU, which is an accessory dwelling unit, to your single family house, effectively kind of making it a duplex. And in, I believe it's in the city of Minneapolis, they have actually passed an ordinance where you can no longer build a single family house. It must be a duplex or a denser.
Wow.
Huh. Yeah, ADUs were made legal in Atlanta, where we live, in 2017. We're seeing more and more of them pop up. Mm-hmm. But even in that zoning law change, we're seeing that the setbacks required to build one are actually make it too onerous in some of these small backyards to actually get one built. So I think you're right that zoning laws are a huge part of the problem when it comes to a lack of affordable housing.
Yeah. So the next issue is the education of landlords and investors. I mean, quite frankly, a lot of people are scared to invest in real estate because they think they're going to be plunging toilets all day.
Yeah.
And that's not really where people want to be. And that's not necessarily the case, but that is the impression that people get. So a lot of the work that I do with investors is from the standpoint of how do I invest in real estate so it actually works for me? Because my goal is to like remove the friction from investment, because investment is where housing comes from, and that's the only place it's going to come from.
Gotcha. Yeah. I love how even just in the beginning of your book, so your book is all about helping people reduce what they pay for rent. Mm-hmm. And I think it's such an admirable subject to tackle, because that's a problem for a lot of people. And you say that the book that you wrote speaks to people who feel that they lack control, but that the knowledge that you're providing can be the source of power for just ordinary individuals. So yeah, would you say it's a lack of knowledge or a lack of confidence? What's the main thing standing in the way of people actually fighting for a discount on their rent?
Well, as both of you know, there is an incredible, almost criminal lack of financial education going on in the Yep. in the school system, just hands down, period, across the board. And then you also couple that with no classes on negotiation at all, really.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard of a negotiation class.
Yeah. Some countries, it's a part of like the culture growing up, but it's not a part of ours.
It's a part of the market, but yeah. That's just not a part of buying groceries here in the U.S.
Right.
Yeah. No, in some cultures it is. So like if you go to like a farmer's market and you will see a bunch of elderly ladies haggling over green beans, like string beans, and they will haggle over every bean. I mean, that is a masterclass in negotiation right there.
Seriously.
And then you couple the lack of education with the consumer training that people get. So people are trained by their retail experiences. So they walk into Walmart, they see something on the shelf, they see a price below that item, they expect to pay that price. Period, hands down. They're not negotiating with the cashier over whatever that item is. And that's their experience. And they walk into the rental situation with that same mentality. And that results in people not negotiating for anything. And it's not just the actual rent that you can negotiate for. It's this apartment may have washer and dryer hookups, but is it possible to get the actual machines? Mm. Or is there a parking space that can come with this apartment? Or is there an extra parking space that I can possibly get? So there are other things that you can negotiate for above and beyond just the rental price. It all depends on what you need and what's most important to you.
So basically, because we're not used to negotiating, and because most of the businesses that we routinely shop in don't have negotiating, it's not a feature of the system, we're walking into this same system with different rules, but we're playing by the other rules.
Mm-hmm. And also, there's also this issue of you have the roof that I need, and a lot of people typically wait until the last minute. So they think if they negotiate, well, I won't get this place that I need like right now.
Mm. That's true. Well, yeah. So speaking of negotiating, and you kind of mentioned folks waiting to the last minute, like, is there a best time of year to score a deal? You know, like, should we have a goal if someone is renting? You know, should they have a goal of their lease running out at a specific time in order for them to have some more leverage? I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. I mean, in general, people should be looking at where they're going to move to probably about 6 weeks out, well, 6 to 8 weeks out from when their lease is up or when they need to change their situation. Because there's a number of factors they got to look at. Neighborhood, will that particular apartment community be the one that I want? Will it have what I need? What are my needs? So all of those questions need to start being addressed. And so there's internal thought work that people need to do as far as assessing their situation. Then there's the legwork they need to do out in the neighborhoods, looking at properties to determine what they actually need. But beyond that, there are specific times of year where you are more likely to get rental deals than others. And it happens every year. And if you think about it, there's a whole slew of people graduating from college in the May, June timeframe. It happens mm-hmm. every year. There's millions of them. Then there's a whole slew of people who are parents, who have kids, they're trying to trying to switch school districts before school starts in August or September.
Yep.
And there's millions of them. So every landlord and property management company in the country knows this. So when it comes to those months, those summer months, you know, June, July, August, September, that's when they're going to, where the asking rents are going to be highest, because they know a lot of people are moving around. There's a lot of demand and there's a lot of competition from other people who are renting. So the flip side of that is, if you wait until, say, December, January, February, there's still going to be apartments that come vacant, but there's fewer people looking and there's less competition. And the reason why this, the reason why you get better deals during that winter period is because of the way vacancy affects landlords. So if I rent, if I have someone living in an apartment, I'm collecting rent on a daily basis. Okay. If that apartment is vacant, I'm not collecting any rent. And the problem with that is I can't ever recoup the rent that I didn't collect. Like, December's gone. I can't get December rent that wasn't paid in December, because nobody's going to pay rent for a month that's already passed.
Just wasted time and lost money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not like a car dealership where if I don't sell you the car today, I can sell you the car tomorrow and you as the consumer still get the same value.
Gotcha. Yeah, that clock's ticking.
Yeah. So and landlords are very well aware that the clock is ticking. So they're going to do the deal in December or January, as opposed to waiting until summer when they can ramp up, you know, when they can ask higher rents.
So would like a tactic as a renter be, let's say it's August or September and you're signing another lease and maybe talking to your landlord and saying, hey, maybe I'd like to sign a 15 or 16th month lease, so that basically you're hitting the market at a time where there is less competition and you could potentially score a lower price the next time around? I mean, is that, and you might even get a price break too for signing a longer lease.
So landlords are aware of the timing issues. So they're less likely to sign a, they're less like, if it's summer now, they're less likely to sign a lease that will land you in that January, December timeframe. Mm-hmm. However, you can, if your lease runs out in summer, you can go month to month instead of signing a whole new lease.
Yeah.
And then when you get to that winter time period, then embark on looking for apartments and have those conversations. The other thing is, if you're a college student and you're just graduated, you know, you could live at home or find a couch to crash on for a few months and then go out and start looking to rent.
Yeah. What about the, like, where you live, like urban, suburban, is like, does it matter? How does that affect your ability to negotiate your rent and to find cheaper rent?
So the typical logic and, you know, academic theory is in downtown is where all the employment is. And the further away you are from downtown, the more transportation costs you have, the more inconvenience you're dealing with. So prices are going to drop off the further away you move from the employment center. So renting out in the suburbs will likely be cheaper than renting right downtown, all things being equal. Now, it depends on what you want to rent. So for example, if you are a single young professional adult, you can rent a room downtown and you're living in maybe a three bedroom apartment, but you'll have two other roommates. And that may very well be cheaper than renting a one bedroom apartment out in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So it really boils down to, a lot of it boils down to what specific needs you have as an individual, because the rooming situation is not going to work for a couple who has a kid. Because, you know, I might like you as an individual and a drinking buddy and all that, but that doesn't mean I want you helping me raise my child.
Sometimes you do, you don't.
One big happy family.
Yeah. Well, Justin, I mean, you mentioned kind of, you know, the differences from renting in a city center versus a more rural area. Working from home, that's obviously had an impact on folks' ability to live anywhere and still have a great job. I think it's like 1 in 7 folks are now working from home. It's a substantially higher rate. How have you seen that impact the rates of rent that cities are able to collect versus more suburban and rural areas.
I mean, it's been huge, and we actually saw that. We saw some of that effect during the whole COVID situation in 2020, yeah. where like rents in downtown urban areas were like dropping by double digit percentages because the demand was lower and people were moving out into the suburbs, into more rural areas. And partly was just we were going through the situation. I don't want to be surrounded by people. But there were other things too, like you lost the benefits of living downtown, like the right. the restaurants, the nightclubs, the bars, like all of that experience went away, and suddenly mm-hmm. the backyard took on a massive level of importance yeah. As far as amenities are concerned.
Right, yeah. The fire pit, the screen porch, they all yeah. gained prominence.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And actually, there's another thing I want to mention on that is that a lot of apartment communities closed their amenities, the on-site gym, the on-site pool, the laundry room.
That's a good point.
They closed those things, and yet they still wanted to charge the same amount of rent for their apartments.
Uh-huh. It's kind of like colleges going to virtual learning, and it's like, tuition's staying the same.
Yeah, and it's not the same product.
Right.
You are no longer giving me the same level of value. And I think there's a really good case to be made for, you know, the rents at while all of those amenities were closed, the rents that you're charging should have come down, because there's actually something in the industry known as amenity-based pricing. And they are adding premiums to rents based on the amenities that they have put into that property and the proximity that the apartment has to said amenities. So to then claim that, it seems disingenuous to claim that amenities have no bearing on pricing in the situation that we went through. Controlling the amenities that you get when you rent an apartment is another way to control your costs. Like, only rent at places that have amenities that you're actually going to use, because whether you use them or not, you're actually paying for them and they're built into your rent.
They don't get utilized nearly as much as you think they will. And so, yeah, you got to make sure that you're actually going to take advantage of the amenities before you sign up and you start paying for them on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
Justin, we've got more questions to get to with you, including we want to talk to single family homes and renting from mom and pop landlords and how that changes the scenario. We'll get to those questions right after this.
All right, we're back from the break. We're talking with Justin Pogue about some of the different ways to reduce your rent. Justin, one of the first things that you outline in your book is that tenants need to understand the landlord's predicament. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so we've already kind of touched on that a little bit in terms of this ticking clock that landlords are dealing with. But most renters don't understand that landlords are also in competition with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just I'm in competition with this other renter for this space. Landlords are actually competing for quality tenants, people who are employed and have good jobs, people who have great credit scores, people who get along well and play well with others. Because when you rent an apartment, you're actually living in a community of people, and you're all like right on top of each other because it's an apartment building. So your ability to get along with the other people around you is important from the landlord's perspective, because one bad apple can drive out good tenants. And good tenants are the ones that are paying the rent every month so that landlord can pay their mortgage and pay their staff and do the things that they need to do.
That's a good point. Well, and also not all landlords are created equal, right? Like some are
not
like,
at all.
In terms of how they handle tenants, that's one thing, right? Like, so do you have any suggestions, one, for finding a landlord that is going to treat you fairly? And also, two, what's the difference between mom and pop style landlords and then some of the giant corporations that own either single family houses, you know, some of these Wall Street firms that now have invested in hundreds of thousands of homes around the country, mm-hmm. or just like an apartment complex that's owned by a big corporation. How does the type of landlord you're dealing with impact your negotiation strategy?
Yeah. So the first piece of advice I would give people in trying to figure out whether they have a good landlord or not is actually talk to the people who live in the community. You know, when you go to visit a community, like you go on the tour and all of that, and that the leasing agent is going to sing the praises of that community because that's their job, and it'll make it sound like it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. After the tour is over, you know, separate yourself from the leasing agent and find one of the tenants that actually lives in the building and ask them, what has been your experience? Do they actually come and repair things when they say they're going to repair things? Is the property manager easy to deal with, or are they difficult to deal with? You know, they said street parking was available. Is that really available at 5 o'clock when I come back from work? So those people are an immense source of information because they live there and they have no stake in whether you rent there or not. Right. They could care less. But if they've had a bad experience, they will share it with you.
I love that, how talking to someone who actually lives in that apartment complex, how that can be helpful. But what about when it comes to negotiating? Is it how does it differ when you're talking to an individual person who owns that house and you're renting from directly, but then versus like a giant corporation and how you're able to get concessions and then how you go about negotiating?
Yes. So you do go about negotiating a little bit differently when you're dealing with a corporation versus, you know, you're talking to the landlord directly. With a corporation, the person that you're dealing with has absolutely zero power as far as your rent is concerned. But that person reports to a boss. So that property manager reports to someone who would typically be a regional manager. And if you present your case in a way that this property manager can then take your case to the regional manager and have an intelligent conversation, then that increases your chances of being able to negotiate for lower rent. And when I mean present your case in the right way is speak the language of the property manager. So you're talking about, for example, how long has this apartment been vacant? Because every day they're losing money. Sometimes there are apartments that people are trying to rent and they're not quite clean and they're not quite ready. There may be costs to them cleaning them up and that kind of thing. So if you say, well, don't worry about it, I'll straighten it up. I'll take care of that for you. Don't worry about it. So you're taking on the role of removing cost or potential expenses from their side, and you're using that to leverage negotiation. Also, people run into situations where you got to renew your lease. So I'm already in the apartment. I've got to renew my lease. Well, it costs you money to go out and find another tenant. So let's have this discussion about reducing the renewal rate because of the other potential costs that you're going to face.
Yeah. I mean, what I hear you talking about here, essentially, granted, like there's only so much of a relationship that you could have with a manager of a property, but relationships mean almost everything in business. And, you know, we're talking about negotiating here, like that is business. And so how important do you think is that relationship that you build with your landlord, either personally or via a manager, and, you know, and maybe slowly it's able to trickle its way up through the company. But like, how can folks use a healthy relationship like that to their advantage?
That relationship is hugely important. And it's important on both sides. It's not just important from the renter standpoint. It's important from the landlord standpoint too. And we'll start from the landlord and move to the renter. As the landlord, I have invested in this property. I've invested my retirement in this property. And you as the renter are living in my retirement investment.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it that I never have before, but I like that.
Yeah. So I need to have a great relationship with that person so they take care of my retirement investment. And we work well together. They'll call when something breaks or there's an issue or whatever, so it doesn't turn into a larger problem. So it really is valuable from the landlord standpoint. Now, from the renter standpoint, if you have a relationship with somebody, you're more willing to talk with them, engage with them, and have that negotiation kind of conversation and get away from that kind of retail mentality of dealing with the cashier and get into the mentality of negotiating with your landlord. And also being open to calling them for when there actually are problems. Because there have been many apartments that I've rented where if people had just called, the problem would have been a $300 problem as opposed to a $3,000 problem.
Yes. There's a little water on the ceiling. And if you get the call then, that's helpful. And it's like, now it's a constant drip and it's going onto the
now
carpet.
There's drywall
yes,
on our couch.
Exactly.
That's wet. Can you
now
fix that?
Now the ceiling caved in.
Yeah. And once the ceiling caves in, now you're talking thousands as opposed to hundreds.
Right.
And I mean, and that can then roll into potential mold issues and all kinds of nasty things that nobody really wants to deal with.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that if you are that kind of tenant that communicates well, and that even like, so I recently I had a tenant and he said, hey, there's like an issue with the burner in the oven and like I can fix it for you and it's like a $15 part. And I was like, thank you so much. Oh, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. And I offered him an additional on top of the part, just like, hey, well, take some money for your time, pay me a little bit less money in rent next month. And it's one of those things where if you're a tenant, that makes sense for you. You're lowering the cost of your rent. And if I'm the landlord, it's going to be cheaper for me if this guy knows what he's doing to fix the oven himself.
And he's obviously, you've incentivized him.
Yes.
Right? Like he's obviously interested in doing that. And so if you're able to kind of channel him in other ways, it's like, oh man, what else can this guy DIY?
And then next time when the lease comes up, I'm going to be less likely to increase rent on him because I'm like, this is the kind of guy who takes care of stuff himself and looks after my place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like renters don't understand the level of stress and frustration that landlords have and the problems that landlords have. I mean, it's maintenance problems, legal problems, marketing issues, like the list goes on and on. Like by investing in a property, you're basically starting a small business. So you have all of those issues that you're dealing with. So any renter who can handle small repair or maintenance issues is basically worth their weight in gold. Because from your standpoint, if I'm going to have that same stove fixed in your example, I got to go out and get three quotes from contractors. Somebody has to be there to let the contractor in so they can actually take a look at the situation. I may have to pay for that for them to come out and do a quote. And then once they get their parts, I got to be there to let them back in. And I'm busy trying to live my life or manage my other units. But if the person who lives there can handle that situation, then, and I just got to kick them back a little bit of rent for doing that.
That's easy.
Yeah. I mean, it's a win-win.
Exactly. I think if you can put yourself, you know, if you're a renter and you can put yourself in the shoes of a landlord and just think, how can I make their life as easy as possible?
And it's identifying their
pain
points.
They will be rewarded
in,
being charged lower rent when the time comes for that rent to creep up a little bit. There's a less likely chance of that, you know, going to a higher amount.
Yeah, it's that relationship, right? It's relationship building, identifying those pain points, helping the landlord, which ultimately ends up helping you.
Yeah, and that's a central tenet of negotiation is understanding the pain points that the other person is dealing with.
Totally. Yeah. So Justin, we talked a good bit about apartment buildings and honestly, even some things too that would apply to single family homes. But we want to ask some specific questions about what to look for when you are looking to negotiate rent with a single family home or with a mom and pop landlord. And so we will get to those questions right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. We're still talking with Justin Pogue. We're talking proven ways to reduce your rent. And with rents somewhat skyrocketing out of control for a lot of folks these days, like these tips are meaningful and they can actually help ensure that every month your lease payment on that apartment or on that single family home is less than it otherwise would be. And, you know, Justin, we talked about like starting those negotiations in advance. I think you said 6 weeks ahead of your lease ending was kind of the ideal time to get the ball rolling.
Yeah, 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah. So do you suggest like a phone call, an email? Like what is there even just like a best strategy when it comes to like the way in which you contact your landlord?
If you're just looking for basic information about a community or whatever, a phone call is fine. If you're actually negotiating with your landlord, I would recommend email or even text message because it creates a paper trail. So we know what we said before and it kind of gives you a guide to it gives you a history that you can refer back to as your negotiations move forward.
Got it. Well, so a little bit ago, we talked about, like, you kind of laughed at the fact that not all landlords are the same or, you know, they're not all created equal. I'm sure a lot of apartment complexes, a lot of companies are doing things well, but I'm sure there's, you know, they're not doing things well. When it comes to, like, mom and pop landlords, I feel that there is a lot that may not necessarily be buttoned up on the business side of things. What mistakes have you seen smaller landlords make when it comes to treating their tenants well and taking care of a property?
Well, first of all, not screening the tenants that they receive. So typically, when you apply for an apartment, they'll look at your income to make sure you can afford to be there. But they should also, in many cases, be doing criminal background checks, sex offender background checks, checking for previous evictions. And part of the reason why you're doing those things is because you want to create a community of people that live and work well together. In those checks, you're looking for evidence that this person has not done that in the past.
Right.
So at least you're in a position to have a conversation with them about, okay, this did not work well in the past. What has happened in the meantime for you to increase your skill level in this area, assuming you even want to move forward to rent with them? I think that's one big mistake that a lot of new landlords make.
And yeah, I mean, that could really bite you in the butt as a landlord. But like, so from a renter's perspective, would any of those, like, is there anything that would be a red flag for a tenant if there was something that a landlord wasn't doing or something that they should be doing? Is there anything that tenants should keep an eye out for when it comes to dealing with a small-time landlord?
So it can actually come down to like just basic things, like as you drive by the property, like, is the yard clean?
Yeah.
Like, because you're looking for, do they care about, does anyone care about this property?
Right.
Because once I move in, I'm stuck in this lease. Like, if nobody cares, then that means I'm taking on the responsibility of doing all of the caring. And if that's the case, I need to make sure that I'm compensated for having to deal with that.
Yeah. Well, I think what you were saying too, Justin, if you want to get to the point even where you can negotiate with your landlord, your current landlord, or a potential landlord, you have to make sure that you're a good tenant. And we've talked about some of those ways. But another thing is, yeah, if your credit is in bad shape, or if you have a bad reference from a prior landlord, that's not going to help you out in negotiation, right? You're going to be lucky if you get to rent that place at all. And so I think, yeah, showing that you have good rental history, good credit history, that's going to be key to being able to negotiate well at the same time.
But if you don't have great credit, there are some ways that you can balance that out. You may be able to pay a higher security deposit.
Mm-hmm.
You may have obtained letters of reference from previous landlords that you can share with this landlord. So there are some things that you can do. Or actually, another thing you might be able to do is pay a number of months of rent in advance if you're dealing with a poor credit situation. So it's all about kind of thinking about it from the landlord's standpoint and addressing the risks, that the extra risk they think they might be taking on accepting you as a renter.
All right. Well, okay. So I want to ask another thing on negotiation. Sometimes, and it's just, I think it's more of a weird behavioral tick for people than it is something that's actually the best business practice, but a landlord might be saying, nope, this is the bottom line. That's the least amount I'm willing to take for monthly rent amount. So it said $1,500 in the ad I posted, and that's my bottom line. But if that's the case, there are probably still other concessions that a tenant could look out for or could ask for that still allow the landlord to keep that bottom line, you know, monthly rental price, but then score in other ways, right? It's not just, that's not the only point of negotiation, right?
No, that's not the only point of negotiation. So other things that you may look for in a rental situation, possibly an additional parking space, possibly free use of the laundry room. Or you may actually negotiate, you know, a discount for paying early.
Mm.
So there are a number of ways to kind of think about that. And in this example, they're saying, you know, $1,500 is their bottom line. But if I am doing things with the property that is removing expenses for you, for example, in a single family example, almost every single family house has a yard. If I'm willing to take care of that yard for you and you do not have to pay a landscaper to come every 2 weeks to do that, I'm removing costs for you. And that $1,500 mm-hmm. price point was based on the costs you thought you were going to have to pay to maintain this property. And I'm changing that calculus.
You're kind of
so
like
that opens the door for negotiation.
Yeah, you're kind of working your way into their books a little bit. It's just like, hey, you need to consider me.
Taking on these small part-time positions around the house so that they don't have to pay all these specialists.
Totally.
Yeah, and actually, we haven't really touched on one of the best ways to save on rent, which is actually working for the landlord. There are a number of smaller-ish apartment communities, you know, 20 to 40 units, where there's an on-site property manager role. Somebody to pick up around the property, be the first point of contact for renters who live there, clean up the pool if there is one, let vendors in when they need to come and repair something. And people who are in that role typically get, you know, 50 to 100% taken off of their rent.
Wow.
For fulfilling that role. And it's a part-time job. So it's possible to have, and I talk about one of these individuals in my book, though it's possible to have a full-time, you know, full-time 40-hour a week job and then do this on the side as a side gig. If you're in a place where, you know, your rent's $1,000 a month, it's a pretty good side gig. And most people don't understand that $1,000, that's after tax money. So that's the equivalent of that 12 grand a year is the equivalent of having, you know, a $15,000, $16,000 side gig.
Yeah, it's better than driving for Uber, right?
Yeah, well, and then also when so many folks do have the option to work from home, they have that kind of flexibility built into their schedules. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe 15, 20 years ago, there's a lot of folks who would not be able to take advantage of something like that.
Right.
But if they're at home on their laptops and for them to step away for 10 minutes, perhaps, to let somebody into the building or whatever it is that might come up, I think that's an awesome way for folks to be able to seriously cut a major, you know, typically the largest line item expense on their budgets.
Doesn't necessarily work for everybody, but
sure,
there's another fringe benefit, and that is you basically get kind of somewhat of a say in who your neighbors are going to be, which is a nice fringe benefit.
So you can get other folks in there who like to frequent the clubs as well and spend their evenings dancing.
Yeah, you know, nice to have some built-in designated drivers.
A quick question here at the end. How can tenants protect themselves and their security deposit? Because that can be a way that some more unscrupulous landlords might take advantage of tenants. How can folks go about doing that well?
Yeah, that happens very often where once you move out, you get this list of charges and it's questionable whether those charges are actually real and legitimate or not. So one thing is to understand a basic accounting concept called useful life. And what that means is there's a certain amount of time that every product is expected to be in service for. And each year, the landlord is taking a deduction off of their taxes for over the course of that life. So, for example, carpet, for instance, typically has a useful life of 5 to 7 years. But we'll use 5 years to make the math easy. So if the carpet costs $1,000, they're depreciating $200 over the course of those 5 years. But once the 5 years is up, the useful life of the carpet is done. They shouldn't be charging you. If you've rented for 5 years in this space, they shouldn't be charging you for replacing the carpet.
Because they had to do it anyway.
They're going to have to do it anyway. Same thing applies to paint, although paint, I believe, is shorter at a two-year lifespan. So there is an advantage to living in an apartment for a little longer than just that single year. So if the useful life of paint is 2 years and you've been there 2 years, it doesn't matter if your child has scrawled all over the walls and made beautiful murals and all of that. The useful life of the paint is used up and they're going to have to paint over anyway. So you should not be charged for that. You should see a big goose egg for paint, you know, hitting your security deposit.
And basically, you're saying if you use that term at fighting back to someone trying to claw some of your security deposit, you can say, listen, this was past its useful life and you cannot charge me for this. You owe me more of my security deposit than you're saying.
Yes. And it actually gets better because it's not necessary. The useful life doesn't start the date that you moved into the apartment. It starts the date when those things were actually installed.
So, yeah, if someone had lived there 3 years before you, then you lived there for 2 years, and now they're trying to charge you for the carpet, it's like, that's not fair.
Right. That's not fair. And being able to use that language of useful life and having that conversation is part of being able to speak to corporations so that that person who has no power can take your case to the person who does have power.
And when you use the right terminology, they know, you know what you're talking about.
This guy
and
they're knows like, what he's talking about.
Let me not mess with this fella. We're just going to give him or her this full security deposit back because they know what they're talking about.
also in certain states, if there's a time limit within which you should get your security deposit back, but certain states allow that if that time period has passed, then you should get all of your security deposit back regardless what was wrong with the apartment, because they took too long to get you your money back.
That's awesome. Justin, so many good tips in this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can our listeners find out more about you and the information that you're providing?
Yeah, absolutely. They can check out rentalsecrets.net. And I'm also on Instagram at rentalsecrets. That's the handle. And I do have an event coming up in February, and they can check that event out at rentalsecrets.net/event.
We will make sure to link to all of that, Justin. We really appreciate you joining us today on How to Money. Thank you so much.
Yeah, really glad to be here. Great conversation, guys.
All right. Joel, what a helpful conversation that was. So many people rent here in America. And like we said, you know, housing, it's the top expense when it comes to our monthly budgets. Anytime we're able to figure out different ways to reduce that expense, we are going to be all about that. And also, too, by the way, I wanted to mention how, like, just I just love, again, how Justin, he likes to go out. He likes to go to a club, enjoy himself, do some dancing, but he likes to do it on the cheap. That just made me so happy hearing just the different steps that he takes in order to ensure that he's not going to overspend when he goes out. Stays hydrated, drinks a lot of water in between songs, that kind of thing.
That's just healthy, man.
No matter what, you need to make sure you drink more water than you probably are. But what was your big takeaway from this conversation specifically about reducing your rent?
All right, so I think there were a lot of good things, but I think probably the biggest one for me was to get into a negotiation mindset.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because at the very
that
beginning...
That was such a great nugget at the very beginning.
You have to realize when you can negotiate and when you can't. And he's totally right. Like, in the checkout line at Walmart negotiation, you have like a, I don't know, 0.5% chance that you're going to be able to negotiate for something. And you know, if the price is different than it was on the shelf when it rings up, then you certainly have a case to be made. But that's less negotiation and just an error, right?
Exactly. But they're going to call the associate over. They're going to take care of that for you.
Yeah. But in the case of real estate and renting a home or an apartment, there are so many different pain points that a landlord has to deal with. And the more you can figure out what those are, and the more you can find a way to help alleviate some of those pain points, the more you're going to be able to negotiate. But you have to get in that mindset, and you have to realize this is different than Walmart, or this is different than the grocery store. This is different than basically anywhere else I go. This is a place where you can negotiate. I think you just have to just realizing that, knowing that, like, guess what? I can ask for a discount here, is going to help propel you to savings. But if you decide that you're going to avoid negotiation because it makes you nervous, you're not going to be able to save.
Totally, man. I felt like that was such a great piece of wisdom that he shared, because it's so true. We have been trained to shop for things a certain way, and it oftentimes involves something being perfect. It's packaged, and this is what it is. Yeah. You know, like there's no room for you talking about it. There's no room for you to find a way to get that price down a little bit. There isn't a whole lot of wiggle room when it comes to the different things that we purchase, whether it be in person or online. And unfortunately, if we take that mindset and apply that to rent, we're not going to be the ones who are advocating for ourselves. But that is what we are encouraging folks to do. My big takeaway, I really liked when he was talking about the amenities-based pricing. There are certain features that, especially apartment complexes, they have highlighted these different aspects of their apartment, whether it's the proximity, whether it's the location in regards to attractions of the city, or whether they are specific amenities that the apartment is providing. But these are these additional benefits that may not be delivering at the level that they used to be. I know a lot of folks, they feel like a lot of their life has resumed to the way things used to be. But I think if we were to take a hard look at what our cities and what our apartment complexes are offering compared to what they used to offer, then you might realize that you are paying for some services that you not only may not naturally take advantage, but they may be amenities that you are not capable of taking advantage of because they are not being offered anymore. I think if you keep that in mind, that might be a great way for folks out there to save some money on rent.
Yeah, rethink those amenities. Like, do I actually use those things? Oh, wait, is there a apartment complex across the street that has fewer amenities and it doesn't even matter because I'm not going to use them, but I can save I don't know, $100 a month. Yeah, I'm moving over there.
I want that bare bones apartment. I want the Aldi of apartment complexes. I want things to still be on the pallets in cardboard boxes.
What if
Don't worry, I will take care of the packaging.
What if Aldi got into the apartment rental game?
If they started building apartments on top of their stores, who wouldn't want to live there, man?
That sounds like paradise. I'm not going to lie. All right, Matt, what was your...
Speaking of paradise, let's talk about this beer.
Yeah, this one was called Spelt's Wrong. It's by Dissolver and Resident Culture Brewing, a collab beer. What was your take on this one? This is like a kind of a funky beer.
Funky sour beer. Holy cow. This thing was delicious. It had those woody notes going on, so you could totally just taste the barrel-aged flavors that were infused into this beer. It was definitely a sour, but it was really acidic, right? Like it wasn't just kind of like that flat sour, but it was sort of like, you know, one of these bright, fresh sour beers that kind of has this tartness going on. This is the kind of sour beer that I could drink, I mean, all the stinking time. Like There are some sours where... I don't know how to describe it. It's just like this sort of dull sour. Like it hits you in the sour receptors, like on the, you know, the, like back behind your jaw on the side of your, like underneath your ears.
Makes you squint your face all up.
Yeah, like it hits you back there, but it doesn't kind of have like that bright, I don't know if it's a sweetness or just
this
a brightness
one, that's what
to
I was going
to
say, this one for a sour had a lot of sweetness going on. It was sweet
like
and
that.
Sour. I agree.
Yeah, it was really good.
It was good. It was unexpected. That's not what I was like assuming I was going to get from this beer, but I thought
but you liked it.
The sweetness with the funkiness kind of worked well. And when we say funky, it's always an interesting word to describe beers, but some of my favorite beers I would describe as funky, and that's because of the wild yeast that they use to make this beer, or I guess they make their own house-made yeasts. But
that's what it says on here.
Yeah, so those are... But
native proprietary cultures.
So yeah, they're not letting the IP for their yeast out. You'd have to pay for that.
Exactly.
But yeah, I love beers that are made with these strains of yeast that create these funky... taste notes. And yeah, I appreciate that this one was a little sweeter than a lot of those. Some of those kind of beers are typically incredibly dry, but this one wasn't. It kind of had like a burst of sweet flavor going along with the funkiness, and I thought that was like kind of a nice concoction, a nice blend of tastes going on together.
Nice, man. Well, I'm glad that you and I got to share this one. Again, this was by Dissolver, with some of the vowels taken out is how you spell it. They are out of Asheville, North Carolina. This was a collaboration with Resident Culture. But that's going to be it for this episode. Like we mentioned, we will link to Justin's site where you can learn more about him. Joel, until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.